Eliphaz. For people like Simeon and Levi, Leah's stout sons, it was a matter for private mirth that just this bold and lawless-sounding title was what their father had, as it were, wrung from the heavenly powers. For Jacob was no fighter. He would never have been the man to do what the original Abraham did, when eastern hirelings, the mercenary troops of Elam and Shinar and Larsa, and beyond the Tigris, harried the land of the Jordan on account of tribute overdue, plundered the cities, and took away Lot of Sodom and his goods. For Abraham, with bold and loyal resolution, got together a few hundred of servants born in his own house, together with neighbors of near faith, people of El Berith, the Most High God, set out with them by forced marches from Hebron, overtook the retiring Elamites and Gojim, and brought such confusion to their rear that he freed many of the prisoners, among them his brother Lot, and carried back in triumph much of the stolen goods. No, that would have been no place for Jacob. He would not have stood up to it. He admitted as much to himself when Joseph began to tell the oft-told tale. He could not do it. As little as, by his own confession, he could have done to his son what the Lord demanded of him. He would have left it to Simeon and Levi to free Lot. But if these two had instituted a massacre among the moon-worshippers, and set up that hair-raising yell which they had at their command on such occasions, he would have veiled his countenance and said, "My soul may not come in your counsel." For that soul was soft and fearful, abhorring the use of force, trembling lest force be its portion, mindful of many occasions on which its virile courage had known defeat. But no violence was ever done by these memories to the dignity or solemnity of the soul, for always and regularly in such states of physical depression there came a ray of light, an influx of the spirit, a powerfully consoling and freshly confirmatory revelation of grace, so that it might lift its head, secure in the knowledge that it had wrestled and overcome out of its own undefeated depths. There was the case of the encounter with Eliphaz, Esau's splendid son. Eliphaz had been born to Esau by one of his Hittite or Canaanite women, worshippers of Baal, whom he had early brought home to Beersheba, and of whom Rebekah, Bethuel's daughter, used to say, "It is a vexation to me to live among the daughters of Heth." Jacob was no longer certain which one of them Eliphaz called his mother. Probably it was Ada, daughter of Elon. At all events, this 13-year-old grandson of Yitzchak was an uncommonly winning youth, simple in spirit, but brave, generous, and high-thinking, upright in body and mind, and holding his dispossessed father, Esau, in great love and respect. In more than one way, life was made hard to him, in the involved nature of the family relations and in matters of faith. For no less than three creeds laid hold on his soul: the god of his grandparents, El Elyon, the Baalim of the mother's side, and a lowering, arrow-shooting deity named Kusach, honored by the mountain folk in the south, the Seirim, or people of Edom, with whom Esau had early had relations, and to whom he later went over altogether. The great affliction and powerless rage of the shaggy man over the event instigated by Rebekah, which had come to pass in the tent where his grandfather sat in darkness on account of his sore eyes, an event which drove Jacob out of house and home and into foreign lands, had been a frightful blow to the lad Eliphaz. The hatred he conceived for his young uncle, who had received the blessing under false pretenses, had a galling intensity beyond his years, and almost mortal. At home, under the eye of the watchful Rebekah, nothing could be done against the thief of the blessing. But when he learned that Jacob had escaped, Eliphaz rushed to Esau and urged him to set out after the traitor to slay him. Esau had fled to the desert. He was too much crushed, too much weakened by bitter weeping over his lower worldly fate to be equal to the deed. He wept because it was in his nature, because that was his role in life. His way of looking at things and at himself was conditioned by inborn habits of thought which held him in bondage as they do all the world, and the character of which had been fixed by the cosmic images of the circling year. By his father's blessing, Jacob had definitely become the man of the full and beautiful moon, and Esau the man of the dark one, that is, the man of the sun, or of the lower world. And in the lower world, one wept, although quite possibly one became very rich in treasure. When later he entirely cast in his lot with the people of the mountains on the south, and with their god, he did it because it seemed fitting. For one thought of the south as the lower world, as one did of the wilderness into which Ishmael, the corresponding brother of Isaac, had been driven out. But long before this time, long before the receiving of the curse, Esau had, from Beersheba, established relations with the people of Seir, from which we gather that blessing and curse alike had only been a confirmation of established facts, and that Esau's character, his role upon earth, had long ago been fixed, and he, long ago, perfectly aware that this was so. He had become a hunter, a rover of the steppes, in contrast to Jacob, who was a tent-dweller and shepherd of the moon. Become so, certainly, according to his nature, on the basis of his strongly masculine disposition. But it would be a mistake, and do small justice to the traditional and established mythology in which his character was rooted, to suppose that his calling alone had imbued him with the feeling and the consciousness of himself and his role as the sun-scorched son of the lower world. On the contrary, at least quite as much on the contrary, he had chosen the calling because of its suitability, that is, out of obedience to the program and knowledge of the myth. Regarding in a cultural light his relation to Jacob, and that Esau, despite all his shagginess, was always ready to do, it was nothing else than the return and the reliving, the rendering into timeless presentness of the relation between Cain and Abel, in which Esau took the part of Cain, to begin with, in his capacity as elder brother, which indeed was honored by the newer world order, but also probably feeling and knowing that since the times of the matriarchy, the deepest preference of the human heart is for the younger and the youngest. If we are to take, as representing an actual occurrence, the story of the mess of pottage, it may be a later addition designed to justify the deception, and Jacob still might easily have believed in its truth, then Esau's apparent folly is explainable on the ground of these sentiments. He may have been so ready to surrender his rights as the firstborn, because he hoped to win for himself, in exchange, at least the sympathies which are traditionally accorded to the younger. In short, the shaggy Esau wept, and showed himself definitely disinclined to any enterprise of pursuit and revenge. He had no desire to kill his able brother, and thus to accentuate the parallel on which the parents had played from the beginning. But when Eliphaz implored, or rather hotly demanded, that he himself might pursue and slay the bearer of the blessing, Esau made no objection, but nodded his permission amid tears. For the nephew to kill the uncle would mean for him a pleasing break with a wretched tradition, and the establishment of a new historical foundation, which should serve as a pattern to later Eliphazes, and relieve him, Esau, at last, from the role of Cain. So Eliphaz got together a few of his father's people, five or six, who usually accompanied him on his expeditions to the land of Edom, armed them from the household stock with long Cain lances, tipped with equally long, sharp points above their gay tufts of hair, and abstracted some camels from Yitzhak's stables in the gray of the dawn. Before it broke, Jacob, riding on a camel between two mounted slaves, and well provided, thanks to Rebekah, with food and presents, had the avenging troop close at his heels. All his life long, Jacob never forgot the fright he got when he understood the significance of the approaching riders. When he first caught sight of them, he flattered himself that Yitzhak had had too early wind of his departure and sent to summon him back. But when he recognized Esau's son, he saw the whole state of affairs, and shook in his shoes. A life-and-death race began. The dromedaries grunting as they strode with their long necks stretched straight out, all the little moons and tassels flying. But Eliphaz and his men were riding lighter than Jacob, who saw his lead melting moment by moment. When he was overtaken by the first flying lances, he gave signal of surrender, dismounted with his men, and awaited his pursuer with face in the dust, and hands over his head. What happened then had touched Jacob's pride and honor more sorely than anything else in all his life. It was calculated to undermine, and would have undermined forever, the dignity and self-confidence of another man. He was obliged, if he wanted to live, and that he did at all costs, not, we must remember, out of common cowardice, but because he was consecrated, because the promise and the blessing handed down from Abraham lay upon him, to try to soften by entreaties the heart of this lad, his nephew, so much younger than himself, and so much lower in station, who, in the heat of his anger, already and more than once had lifted the sword above his head, to reach him through self-abasement and tears and flatteries, through whining appeals to his magnanimity, with a thousand pleas and excuses. In a word, by thoroughly demonstrating the fact that it was not worth Eliphaz's while to turn his sword against such a groveling suppliant. He did it. He kissed the lad's feet like one frenzied. He flung whole handfuls of dust in the air to fall back upon his head. His tongue ran without stint, imploring, conjuring, in a fluency urged on by fear, designed and calculated to daze the boy's astonished senses and prevent him from the rash commission of a fatal deed. Had he intended the deception? Had he urged it? Was it his idea? Might his entrails be consumed in sacrifice if that were even remotely the truth? It was the mother and aunt who had conceived and willed the whole in the weakness of her excessive and undeserved love for him, and he, Jacob, had done his utmost against the plan, telling her how great was the danger that Isaac might discover all, and curse not only him, but the all-too-ingenious Rebekah as well. Eliphaz must know how desperately he had urged upon her his position in the eyes of the noble firstborn son, even if the plan should succeed. Not blithely, not lightly and audaciously, but with fear and trembling, had he entered, bearing the wine and savory meat, with the skins on his hands and his neck, arrayed in Esau's festal garment, into the beloved father's and grandfather's tent. The sweat had run down his joints for fear, his voice had died in his throat, when Isaac asked him who he was, and touched him, and smelt him. But Eliphaz's aunt had even remembered to anoint him with the scent of the flowers of the field. He, a deceiver, he was much more a victim of the guile of womankind. Adam, tempted by Eve, the friend of the serpent. Let Eliphaz his life long, and might he live several hundred years and longer, beware of the advice of woman, and avoid by wisdom the snare of her deceitfulness. He, Jacob, was entangled therein, and was destroyed. He, the bearer of a blessing? But how could it be said that his father had blessed him? A mistaken blessing like that, bestowed against the wish and will of the recipient? Had it any worth or weight? Could it avail? He was perfectly well aware that a blessing was a blessing, having its full value and efficacy, and only asked to confuse Eliphaz's mind. And again, had he, Jacob, taken advantage by word or deed of the error, spreading himself in the house and crowding out Esau, his rightful superior? Not in the least. Quite the contrary. He willingly left the field to his brother. Rebekah herself had remorsefully urged him forth. He was going out into the unknown, never to return, into exile, into the underworld, and his part would be weeping for evermore. Let Eliphaz slay him with the edge of his sword. He, the cock-pigeon with the bright pinions, the young mountain bull in all his pride, the beautiful buck-antelope. But since the Lord had said to Noah that he would require the blood that was shed of man, and since today it was no longer as it had been in the days of Cain and Abel, but there were laws in the land, the violation of which might become highly dangerous to Eliphaz's noble young person, all that on account of his uncle, if he were slain. Whereas, if he were set down and made naught of, sent empty forth to wander in a land where he would be a stranger and a servant, then might the heart of Eliphaz be heavy with joy, and his mother blessed among the daughters of Heth, for that he had held back his hand from the shedding of blood, and turned away his soul from wrongdoing. Thus Jacob rattled on, pouring out pleas in the urgency of his fear, until young Eliphaz was amazed and his head fairly swam. He had expected to find a defiant thief. Instead, here was a repentant sinner, whose humility seemed fully to re-establish his father's lost dignity. Eliphaz was a good-natured soul, like his father. A warm rush of magnanimity replaced the fire of anger in his soul, and he cried out that he would spare his uncle's life, whereat Jacob wept for joy, covering with kisses Eliphaz's hands and feet and the hem of his garment. Slight disgust and some little embarrassment came to mingle with loftier sentiments in the breast of the youth. He felt angered at his own wavering, and harshly told his uncle that all the valuables must go back, everything that Rebekah had given him. It belonged to Esau, the injured party. Jacob tried to soften the decision, but Eliphaz simply shouted at him to be quiet, and had him plucked so thoroughly that nothing was left but his life. All the gold and silver vessels, the jars of finest oil and wine, the neck and arm bands of malachite and cornelian, the incense, the sweetmeats made of honey, all the embroidered and woven stuffs which Rebekah had packed in his saddlebags, it all had to be disgorged. Even the two slaves who had stolen from the court, one of them now bleeding from a lance wound in the shoulder, had to turn back with the animals they led. And then Jacob, with nothing but a couple of earthen water jugs at his saddle bow, might continue his dark way eastwards. Who can say in what a frame of mind? His head lifted up. He had saved his life, his precious, covenanted life, for God and the future. What were gold and cornelian to set against that? For life is all. And young Eliphaz had been even more brilliantly swindled than his parent. But at what a price! Above and beyond the valuables, it had meant the loss of the man's whole honor. For how could one be more shamed than Jacob was, having bowed his head in the dust before a stripling, whining, his face smeared with dust and tears? And then, what had happened straightway after the degradation? Almost immediately, at most a few hours later, by starlight, he reached the town of Luz, lying on one of the terraced and vine-clad slopes of that undulating countryside, a place unfamiliar to him, as indeed was all the region. A few square houses huddled together at half the height of the path-marked hill. An inward voice exhorting him to take shelter here for the night, he guided his camel up the road. The beast was still frightened and unruly from the late lamentable episode, and he felt ashamed before it. He watered the animal at the fountain outside the wall, and washed the traces of his shame from his own face, whereby he felt his heart sensibly lightened. Yet in his beggared state, he avoided asking hospitality of the people of Luz, but led his camel, now his sole possession, uphill beyond the settlement, and as far as the flattened summit, the sight of which made him poignantly regret that he had not reached it sooner, for the place had a stone circle, a Gilgal, which marked it as a sanctuary, and here young Eliphaz, the highway robber, durst not have touched him.